about to link up, take our microphones to Belfast and to our guest Máirtín Ó-Maolaodha. And Máirtín is chairman of the Belfast Media Group. He's publisher of the Irish Echo and IrishCentral.com in New York. He's an Irish speaker, yes, an Irish speaker, and he believes strongly in the promotion of culture as the bedrock of success and diverse community. He has served as Lord Mayor of Belfast, friends, and he will tell us about the 9th annual New York, New Belfast conference coming up next Thursday and Friday here in New York City at the American Irish Historical Society and at PRAE. We go live to City Hall in Belfast as we welcome our friend Máirtín Ó-Maolaodha. Máirtín, you're very welcome.
Adrian, thank you. It's I'm not only coming from Belfast, but I'm coming from Belfast City Hall. I'm just come in from a rally outside, a marching rally for marriage equality. This is the only part of these islands, Britain or Ireland, where marriage equality isn't in the law. And the fact that there's a huge crowd outside, I think, is evidence of the change we've seen in the 9 years since the New York, New Belfast conference started. And I think that most of that change has been thank God, most of it has been very positive.
You are among your awards, of course, the Community Relations Council Award for Civic Leadership, the Pride Festival Award for Best Political Contribution to the LGBT community, and you hold a very a significant honor from the Ancient Order of Hibernians in America, the JFK Medal, their highest honor. Let me just ask you, before we get into the conference itself, many would perhaps wonder about the status of the Assembly in Northern Ireland, which seems to be logjammed, and how that is going to affect a major change coming up this coming year, Brexit, the British exit from the European Union. Can you just fill us in, you know, at least briefly on the current situation in Northern Ireland with respect to the Northern Ireland Assembly?
Yeah, yes, and I think it's for all those who love Ireland and who have supported the peace process and watch the progress, and maybe we don't make global headlines anymore, but that may be a good thing. But for those who have been positive about trying to encourage justice, reconciliation, peace building, I think it's distressing that now we're into well into the second year of no assembly at Stormont, no executive at Stormont, a political vacuum. And you know, and I know who benefits from political vacuums are people of ill will and people on the extremes. And therefore, it remains, I think, for me and for Sinn Féin, remains a political priority, but also a peace priority to find a way to reconstitute, reestablish the Assembly. Only 90 members now. Adrian, one of the great changes in the last election in 2017 was Unionists lost their majority after almost 100 years. A big, strong nationalist cohort in the Assembly, which has never actually met. And then, of course, I was a member of the Executive. I was Finance Minister when it really collapsed in January 17. So what do we need to get back? Because many of my friends say, look, just get back in, and I'm sure you will find a resolution to these issues of human rights and of equal respect and what John Hume called parity of esteem. But the reality is that we almost got the DUP across the line in February on a political agreement, which I think was fair. It certainly wasn't everything I wanted in it. And when Arlene Foster, who had agreed to that in the room, with her top lieutenants, as it were, when she went back to the DUP to say, okay, we've had a year of political stasis, here's a compromise, an agreement to get back in, she couldn't get the backing of her own party. Was that because she didn't sell it hard enough, or because the extremists won the day? But whatever, it means that we haven't made any progress, and Martin McGuinness, his vow was that we would not return to the status quo, the late Martin McGuinness. And I suppose the options on the table for Sinn Féin and for the Nationalist electorate is, do you go back in, having made no changes at all in the toxic way in which the executive was operating in terms of disrespect and arrogance towards minorities, not just towards nationalists, but towards minorities. So the news on that front isn't positive. On the other hand, I think that the news which will give people heart is that the community is very robust, strong, confident. We are facing the perils of Brexit, the existential threat of Brexit to our well-being, to our economy, to our jobs, to the peace process in terms of the support we get from Europe. And people are buoyed up. So it's almost a contradiction, Adrian.
Yeah.
Even though we don't have a government, people still feel very, very buoyed up. But I think the challenge for all of us, how do you get the element of magic to get back into Stormont when the DUP are holding Mrs. May to ransom in Westminster? She needs their votes to stay in power. And where the DUP are saying, you know, we're not going to change. We want to return to what was there, not only in 2016 of yours, but also almost in 1969.
Yeah, if I can play devil's advocate for the moment, could there not be an interpretation that even without a sitting assembly in Northern Ireland, that Northern Ireland seems to do very well anyway, and that the benefits of the Good Friday Agreement, that most of them have kicked in, and that Northern Ireland, in fact, from a cultural aspect and from inward investment, which we'll talk about in a minute, that all of that is smoothly, you know, rolling along, and that what we on our side here would assume is that with or without the devolved government and an assembly in Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland is in fact up and running and in better financial condition and than it had been. So you can't, you know, write off the intent and the benefits of the Good Friday Agreement.
Well, I think that's very perceptive, and it's accurate, and you're absolutely right to attribute those successes and the progress to the Good Friday Agreement. And whatever about the Assembly and Executive, the Good Friday Agreement endures, must be protected, has been vindicated and validated by the progress made. And you're also right in that in many, many ways, people are ahead of the politicians. And evidence of that is, you know, this beautiful sunny day in Belfast and people marching to the streets to demand marriage equality and same-sex marriage. And the gains also, you know, it gives me great heart that yesterday another hotel opened in Belfast, a Maldron, a fairly large hotel.
Yes.
On the 20th of June, Howard Hastings of the Europa Hotel, he will, of the Europa in Culloden, will open the biggest hotel in the city, the Grand Central Hotel, as new Hampton Suites by Hilton opening, and so on and so forth. So, and these are job spinning projects. Unemployment is at an all time low, and I do believe the reconciliation process is embedding, and that
yeah.
many young people who don't have the hang ups or the baggage that those of us who are older have, that they're getting on with it, but we can't, I think, accept that on key areas that there will be no progress. And those key areas for me are the lack of parity of esteem. I mean, the Good Friday Agreement was all about an historic compromise between green and orange and trying to encourage the white and up peace in between them. But parity of esteem has to mean that both traditions are embraced, encouraged, promoted. And yet the reality is, as we know, The DUP are standing firm against that parity of esteem, and that applies to other minorities, and applies also to the terrible, difficult task we have of dealing with the past. So you're right to say there's progress made. I think all of us who, and this includes yourself, all of us who have been boosters for Belfast and boosters for peace, I think when we look around, we should say we played a small part in that, because the transformation, I'm not sure, maybe 3 or 4 years since you were here, maybe 3 years,
Adrian,
but the transformation is breathtaking. And I was out last night with some of our American friends from California and from Boston, and the city at 9 o'clock last night was, you know, as many tourists as you would see in 42nd Street on a Friday night. And that has added to the sense of well-being, the sense of progress. So what I would say about the progress is not don't write it off, but to say, well, why should we settle for still some people still riding on the back of the bus? Why can't we take the progress that the Good Friday Agreement has delivered and build on that to deliver the entire promise and potential of the Good Friday Agreement? And that's, I suppose, that we're on the horns of that particular dilemma at the minute, because we're not in government, and of course the reason to be in government is to deliver more positive change for people.
You served as Lord Mayor of Belfast, and you know, Anya and I were indeed delighted to visit you at that time, and were struck by you know, the reality that City Hall in Belfast, where you're standing right now, became unlike what many might perceive. It was a City Hall of the community, of both sides of the divide. And again, if we were to indeed, I think a lot of listeners and people in general, if they were to see the level of cooperation and the lack of the bitterness that most people here might associate with Catholics versus Protestants and Unionists versus Nationalists, and that this was a holy war that was taking place. That has gone out the window, and I think it's good to point out. Would you agree with that?
Well, please God. I mean, I don't think we still battle with sectarianism, and that can come from different sources. So, the as Mary Magalhães famously says, you know, peace isn't a destination; it is a journey.
Yeah.
But I do, we do have this little saying among ourselves: we bring our friends to Belfast. Let's surprise, astonish and inspire them. And that has been the challenge of Lord Mayors of Belfast, for citizens of Belfast, and it's a challenge also for everyone who loves the city and lives in the city. And some things that I think would surprise those who don't visit here is that while we have nowhere near the diversity of a New York or a Queens, this is increasingly a diverse city, and the diversity in itself has been a good antidote to orange and green antagonisms and animus. And I'm very pleased that this, at the New York New Belfast Conference on Thursday and Friday, a gentleman called Rajesh Rana, whose father was one of the first Indian immigrants into Belfast, built a number of hotels, and the Ranas have a two new hotels opening this summer. I'm delighted that one of the speakers will be Rajesh from Belfast, and I love that idea, which wouldn't be surprising at all if you saw a spokesperson for the city of Toronto or Philadelphia or California or whatever, for San Francisco. But we don't do enough of that in Belfast, so it would be cheering for me to bring a man of Indian heritage, like a Taoiseach, of course, talk about the work that he has done and his family's done to change Belfast. So when you talk about the lessening, hopefully, or the pushing into the background, the big constitutional issue of the orange and green, that still remains a major challenge and burden and hurdle. Mm. But the things I think would cheer, among the things that cheer, are the increasing diversity of Belfast. I mean,
I have the most diverse constituency, and you know, yesterday I was with the Romanian Roma people, who are traveller people, the gypsy people, who have 2,500 Roma in my South Belfast constituency, almost full employment, because they do the jobs that we Irish are now think ourselves too good to do. And then I have a strong Bangladeshi community as well, Muslim community who enjoy full employment because they run all the Indian restaurants. And of course, we have a strong Filipino and another very strong Korean community that work in Kerr services. And that's before I mentioned the EU communities who live here, led by the Polish. So those are changes which you don't really see in the newspapers, but I think you do experience them when you come here, and they are positives, Adrian, in everything we're trying to do.
Well, there's nothing, I'm biting my tongue because, listening to your laying out for us the advantages of, of the immigrant story and the diversity of not only Northern Ireland but throughout Ireland as being a positive. To bed that our leaders at the moment, anyway, in this current administration, can't recognize that, and of course you never know what you have until it's gone. But anyway, that will have to be a story for another day. But yes, diversity, works, and whether that's in the U.S. or whether it's in Ireland or any other place, we have to recognize, the immigrant influence is and always has been a very positive one. I would like to talk about the Belfast, New York, the New York New Belfast Conference, which some 9 years ago, I distinctly remember, your mantra, your theme was for shaping the future, and the future, of Belfast, but also the future of Northern Ireland. That first conference where, many would have said, well, why are you bringing a delegation here? Why... who's going to, is this going to be a stop off in Washington where the delegation meets a congressman or whatever? You made that into totally rolling out business that would be good not only for Belfast, but also for New York. And, you picked... New York, and as you alluded to there, whereas the New York New Belfast Conference is held in New York, you have people from all over the United States and beyond coming to the conference. Explain what your goal was on day one.
I think the first principles are very important, Adrian, because it reflects well an attitude on Irish America. I'm of an advanced age today, so I remember the 70s and 80s in Belfast, a time of great sorrow and division and violence and a very bleak time. And really, when the peace process started, the big lesson for me was any involvement from Irish America will be a positive. It will, by and large, as we found, especially when it comes from government, it will be bipartisan, it will be even-handed, but the little bit of sunlight that America brought in, and of course President Clinton is an exemplar of this, and George Mitchell, but even every Irish-American group, from the Hibernians to the Brehons, to the Irish-American Unity Conference, to state delegations, to Billy Bulger and Governor Weld coming from Massachusetts back in the mid-90s, Irish-American involvement is always to the advantage of those three pillars which are important to progress here, which is peace building, reconciliation, and justice. So what I wanted to do was try and find a way to almost a conduit for Irish-America to continue to remain engaged in the progress we were making. I think that's the first thing. The second lesson is put good people together in a room, let them talk about the things they love, and then let them work out how they can build these bridges, transatlantic bridges of mutual benefit, hopefully bring as much gain to both sides. And,
right.
You know, as I'm not an Irish American, of course, we don't understand, maybe emotionally can't understand the great reward and satisfaction Irish Americans get in a homecoming, what the Detroit Undertaker poet, Thomas Lynch, I think, called it in the passage. Talks about this amazing journey of discovery when Irish Americans do come back to Ireland. And what we have done, we have added a layer to that. We have said, yeah, come back and discover Ireland and reconnect. But what if you could reconnect in a really a deeper basis where if you're interested in sport, you build up a sporting link. And that has happened, really. That's
yeah.
been delivered in a huge level now in Belfast. Are you interested in arts? Professor Scanlon from Harvard was here last year with the Beckett monologue plays, which he brought to Belfast. Are you interested in politics? The American Irish legislators from Albany now have been here several times, as has the California state delegation.
Yes.
I are in particular if you're interested in business, because business creates jobs and jobs change lives and give people opportunity. So that's why we do the New York New Belfast conference. It has to deliver benefits for all those who take part, but it's has a very serious purpose, and that purpose is to make sure that this road we're on, that we continue to make progress. And just to say again, because this is miraculous, I think the American companies, the blue chip companies in Belfast, and Belfast is a city of 330,000 souls. I don't know a U.S. city of 250,000 people who has as many U.S. blue chip companies as we have.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have the New York Stock Exchange and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and Citigroup and Liberty IT and Allstate and Tyco, Johnson Controls. So the list goes on, and that isn't just because those companies have an Irish American connection, but you can be sure many of them had made a real difference when decision was being made about where to locate their business, and those businesses, in my view, have transformed our proposition and created great opportunity. So yes. There's a purpose behind it all.
Yes,
I think it's working, Peter.
It definitely is working, and sometimes there's a misconception that inward investments, say, into Northern Ireland, into Belfast, that there's some Grand Marquis kind of, semi-sentimental attachment that drives some, you know, money into Northern Ireland. We don't even stop to think of, well, wait a minute, if American companies are investing in Northern Ireland, primarily in Belfast, that's not a charitable or a sentimental attachment. Nobody invests unless they expect a return, and in fact, Belfast and the New York New Belfast Conference has gone a long way over 9 years to actually showcase that. It's not just, to take one aspect of it, Southern Ireland does very, very well with inward investment because of their low tax structure and so forth. So,
yeah.
So who would go to Northern Ireland where there isn't as favorable a tax advantage unless there was something about Northern Ireland, Belfast, that actually brought a return? Why wouldn't they all go down to the south and stay there and take advantage of the the disparity in terms of the tax advantages?
Yes, and I mean, I've great respect for the IDA, Enterprise Ireland, the Irish government, when they when they get serious about bringing in investment or forming partnerships or get serious about innovation hubs, or they are absolutely brilliant. I mean, I do think they're among the best in the world, not only making a proposition for investment, but then delivering on it. And it's no surprise that 10 out of 10 of the world's top internet companies are now based in the Republic of Ireland.
Yeah.
Our proposition, I'm pleased as well, has been built on talent, and has been vindicated. I mean, it cheered me when I heard Tom Hall, who's one of the most senior people in the world in Allstate, saying that his operation in Belfast, Derry and Strabane was a world leader. And by the way, it wasn't, you know, just an add-on. It was,
right.
It was a global centre of innovation and of excellence. Our friends in Liberty IT, which is a Boston company, of course, again,
yeah,
out of Belfast, won about 20% of its global IT people are providing security from Belfast. So again,
yeah,
best in the world. And then one that cheered me recently is a gentleman called Giancarlo DeVecchi, whose connection, he links Guadalajara, Portland, Oregon, and Belfast, because that's the three bases, at a conference recently in Belfast, saying that nothing compares to the quality, the commitment and the excellence of the young people we are recruiting in Belfast. So it has to work. And, you know, that also applies to so many other areas of cooperation, because sympathy and interest will get you so far.
Yeah.
But unless you can really deliver, then you can't build on that. And one of the things that has really cheered me recently, we do now have, we're the only professional ice hockey team in Ireland is Belfast. We now have each year 4 US college teams coming over here playing their points. But now we started the basketball classic. Last year we had 4 universities, college teams. This year we will have 8 teams. And we will hold our Belfast International Homecoming, a business conference during that. But the wonderful thing about that is that the basketball people enjoy the tournament. The alumni who travel are people who really support the basketball team, but now they have an opportunity, if they're Irish Americans in particular, to find out more. So that's a win-win, and the more relationships,
yeah,
and partnerships, which are win-win, the better for us all.
Could we get out of the way the perception that, particularly in terms of investment in Ireland, that Northern Ireland is forever at loggerheads, with the Republic, in terms of grabbing whatever is coming inward? What is the level of cooperation with Southern Ireland, particularly in the area of economic advantage and, the stability and the competition?
Well, I think it was a great disappointment. I think it was 2 years ago where Arlene Foster, the leader of the DUP, accused the IDA or Enterprise of stealing jobs from Invest Northern Ireland. I think that sort of talk is,
yes,
nonsensical. I think the people who exemplify the belief that if one part of the island does well, it all does well, and north of the border does well, it all does well. The people who exemplify that for me are the Consul Generals of Ireland in New York. Barbara Jones, most recently I remember sitting with some of the IDA people in her offices in the consulate in New York, Kieran Madden, of course. And they have been generous to a point above and beyond in terms of opening doors. And it's true that you've got New York, New Belfast conference as well. Because if you were narrow-minded about this, you would say, why should the Irish government waste resources or time in trying to promote the city of Belfast? But my experience has been that every agency that represents the Irish government will open doors, will cooperate, will go above and beyond. And really, I think what has held that back has been some of the ministers north of the border, some people in the Northern Ireland executive, who have refused for political reasons to cooperate, and really have, you know, both sides of the island ramping up their proposition. And if you remember, Julian, back when the Good Friday Agreement was signed, there was a discussion over whether we should have one body responsible for foreign direct investment into the island. And it's always a matter of regret we didn't get that. We did get tourism, Ireland.
You sure did.
And no one could dispute that tourism Ireland has delivered again and again and again and again. And you know, there's the benefits of working, setting the politics, leading the politics at the door, and working as one unit to promote tourism onto the island. So I look forward to every day where we'll have increased cooperation. Maybe if we get the executive back, please God we will, that we might have an economy minister, and this has never happened, an economy minister who'd be much more open to building together in consort with Enterprise Ireland. We do have Intertrade Ireland, which is an all-Ireland body, but you know, I don't see anyone in the Irish government who would be set their face against that cooperation. In fact, my experience has been over the last year that the Irish government has been absolutely resolute in defending the people and the citizens of the North of Ireland from all sides. And in fact, no one's done a stronger case to oppose Brexit and the perils, the economic perils of Brexit and the Irish government.
Let's just talk about Brexit and how that will affect, say, the island of Ireland, and in particular, say, Northern Ireland. The island of Ireland, of course, many would feel that Brexit was going to have very little impact on Southern Ireland. I think that's more wishful thinking than practical, I think it is. But for Northern Ireland, is that another political football that we can witness now over the next few months?
Yes, and as you say, we're reaching the crunch time. Michel Barnier, the lead negotiator for the EU, said recently, he said, this is lose-lose. He said, the UK is going to lose and the EU 27 are going to lose. The only people who believe that there is going to be advantages for Britain or for the North of Ireland are ideological Brexiteers. There is no evidence that this will be of any benefit, certainly won't be of economic benefit for the UK. I'm you know, you can be despondent about this in some ways, in that we have a little bit of a right backwater here at the minute, in that the state of Northern Ireland is the only place where rights which are now enshrined and will be enshrined in law south of the border and in Britain aren't available here. Brexit's going to make matters worse. It's back to the ideology of empire, of splendid isolation, of Britain as a great trading nation. And it's counterproductive. They've already lost the economic performance in G7 terms. The UK has dropped to the bottom of that league. But for us, it definitely will not be beneficial. I mean, as you know, I spent a lot of time in the US saying to companies, don't need to go to Dublin. Dublin's magnificent, but why we came to Belfast and benefited our Derry and benefited from the cohort coming to the universities. And by the way, you still have access to every European. Of course, I can't say that anymore. And for me, that's a great disadvantage. But set jobs to the side, set economic damage to the side for the minute. It's the cultural damage which is the most perturbing to me, because we have two generations who, especially for the young people, who see themselves as Europeans. Mm-hmm. And part of being seen as Europeans is being proud of the peace that we have fought for and defended. And the European Union regards the Northern Irish peace process as its crowning achievement. And it created an equilibrium here where young people who are, say, Irish citizens, living in Belfast or Derry or Maharfelt or Newry, they knew they could cross the border. They could access services south of the border as needed, and indeed in any other European state. And there's a nice balance in that helped the peace to grow and to prosper and give people confidence that, you know, we were fighting our way through these problems. For me to tell people, even though a majority here voted to stay, to remain in the European Union, 56%, and of course the principle of consent is written into the Good Friday Agreement, that is, there'll be no change to the constitutional position without a majority voting for it. And while this isn't what was thought about in terms of the constitutional position, this is, you know, really a huge threat to, an existential threat to to our well-being. So I don't think I can stress enough how much young people feel themselves to be European. We're very proud of the fact, even this goes back a long time, but in 590 AD, St. Columbanus set off from Bangor Monastery to Europe, where he set up the St. Gallen Monastery. St. Gallen, now a famous UNESCO site, and finished his life at Bobbio and died in 614. So we had people going to Europe in the golden age of bringing Christianity back to Europe. And we've been so proud to be Europeans in recent, yeah, in recent years. And it's not only the economic advantages, but the where it put us and where it put our values, I think, has been very important to us. And this undermining of that, this wrenching us away from that. And by the way, only one party here supported. Only one party supported Brexit. That's the DUP.
Yeah.
So we're now going to be hostages to this handcuffed to the DUP in this episode of self-harm. And it's an ideological which is the DUP. The DUP, though they will deny it, they want to see more division between North and South. And they're denying that, but that's why they voted for for Brexit.
And who knew their votes, the unionist votes of Northern Ireland, would in fact become an integral part of the success, again, going to back to Theresa May and whatever. That seems to be somewhat diluted in the sense that Britain is having, I wouldn't say second thoughts, but they're too far in. The ideal hope that, you know, there would be some backpedaling and maybe there'll be another referendum and so forth, that's not going to happen at this stage, would you say?
Well, I agree with you. This is being driven by a small cadre of Brexiteers within the Tory party, within the Conservative party. It is Brexit at any cost, and you'll be sure that what happens to those of us who live on this island is of little or no interest to them.
Yeah.
I do think it's magnificent that the EU27, that the EU negotiators at the Irish government stayed firm. I hope they continue to stand very firm on the fact there needs to be a bespoke solution for the north of Ireland. We need to stay in the customs union. We need to stay in the single market as much as possible, certainly in terms of all Ireland activity. And in terms of the whole Ireland economy, we need to have the protections of the Good Friday Agreement, especially against discrimination. So I agree with you, these Brexiteers, it doesn't matter what calamity befalls the British people, they are committed to it. And we need to make sure that as they exit, that we have a special solution to mitigate against the damage of that.
Can we maybe you can bring us the general sense of the citizens of Northern Ireland. Is there a sense that the return of the border, that's not going to happen, you know, and if we have, you know, there'll be a niche cut out, you know, for Northern Ireland regardless of what happens in Britain. Is that somewhat naive?
Well, I don't think people are as it were, having a laissez-faire attitude to it or are nonchalant about it. I do believe that many people fear there will be a return of a border. The recent polling, when people were asked did they want to stay in the European Union, the percentages went up almost to 70% and more. It was 56% in the referendum, but they've been climbing. So people are fearful, not only because of peace process setback, political process setback, but also, you know, people don't want this isolationism.
Absolutely.
People do believe in trying to get on well with our neighbours in Europe, our neighbours both sides of the border, our neighbours both sides of the peace walls in Belfast. And hand and heart, I couldn't say to you today that we'll muddle through this, that there won't be a hard exit or a hard Brexit or a hard border. No one knows. We, you know, the Irish government said again recently, the EU had asked for significant progress to be made by June, mm-hmm. and Simon Coveney, the Tanist Minister for Foreign Affairs, said this week that there's been no progress made. So it doesn't look good. You know, we all sort of hope it will be all right on the night.
Yeah.
But there is this dilemma. The DUP are saying they want, of course, they are Brexiteers, and they've been against the European experiment for 40 years. And the British can't square this circle. If they want to deliver for the DUP, who are keeping the Tories in power, then they can't deliver a solution for the EU, because the EU is, and fair play to them, the EU is saying no hardening of the border, protected the trade agreement, and a bespoke special arrangement for the north of Ireland. So someone is going to be let down very badly. Adrian, and remember, we're talking about June. It's not a summit now in June. But October's only around the corner. And the British then leave in March. So the time frame is tightening, and that we are really, it's a do or die moment for me. And Brexit, as you've observed, Adrian, the upside of Brexit, if there can be such a thing, even though I do accept this loss, or lose, is that it has increased interest and support for a united Ireland, whatever shape that will take. And then when we do get to this unity poll or a border referendum, it will be, the question won't be, do you want a united Ireland? It will be, do you want to rejoin the European Union?
Yeah.
And in those circumstances, I do believe that we will get a border poll, and I do believe it's winnable.
For those I assume that the New York, New Belfast conference has something to do with and is exclusive to those who have a checkbook, who can come in, who can do something, of a practical basis with a dollar, sign.
Yep.
Looking at your list of speakers and participants, from Tom DiNapoli, who is the controller of the state of New York, and then you have Mike Cusack, New York Assembly. You have Brian McCabe, who is the chairman of the Executive Council of the American Irish Historical Society. Christine Keneally, who is superstar, but also professor of at Quinnipiac University, Ireland's Great Hunger Institute. You have Corey Johnson, Speaker from the City Council, Danny Drum. You have Belfast own Geraldine Hughes, a great number of speakers who will not all be speaking of just investment. There's culture. It's a two-day, very, very poignant conference, which covers all of those aspects. It's not just, again, it might be perceived as, okay, well, we're going to talk money. It's actually a great platform for the interchange of the cultures of both cities.
Absolutely, and it's fun. Adrian, was like, no one really wants to engage in a partnership that isn't going to be fun, and it's about friendships. And you just listed, some people who have made a phenomenal contribution to Belfast. Tom DiNapoli, as controller, has made the largest ever single investment into an equity fund in the north of Ireland,
right?
And remains a steadfast friend. Christine Keneally, our friends at Quinnipiac University, of course, what a contribution they have made to the island of Ireland and to Irish heritage, and what a thrill it is that the Coming Home exhibition, exhibition, will be coming to Derry
in January, as well as
Dublin and Skibbereen. And the message I think that we're sending out is, first of all, everyone's welcome, and the opening night at the American Irish Historical Society on Thursday night is really focusing on arts and culture. 50 years since Van Morrison issued his seminal, iconoclastic Astro Weeks album in New York. Belfast artists, they're celebrating 200 years, 200th birthday of Frederick Douglass, who gave phenomenal address in Belfast, which we were in 1845, which we will reenact. So lots of fun and lots of culture. And then the next day, certainly, in Corey Johnston, the new Speaker of New York City Council, but who's been in Belfast, who's been in, you know, who's been in my constituency meeting some of the ethnic minorities. Danny Drum addressed a meeting, a dinner here, 300-400 people, about his journey in New York. So one of the things I'm proud of is that we put Belfast on the visiting menu of American leaders. But I suppose the message I would have to people is, look, whatever area of life you're involved in, why don't you try and expand it to include Belfast? And our friend Rob Walsh, the former business commissioner, now a lecturer at NYU, he always does a walking tour on the afternoon of the conference, which will be Friday the 8th of June with Hudson Square. But I keep meeting people at different walks of life in Belfast who say, do you remember when we went to Myrtle Avenue in Brooklyn? No, we went to the Bronx. No, we went to Red Hook. Because these are, we always find a great bunch of people of change makers, to use the jargon.
Absolutely.
And Rob's contribution has been to try and say, look, here's what we have learned about building neighborhoods and building communities. So my message to everyone is, whether you're involved in a pipe band or a choir or a reading circle or a business network, put Belfast on the list. Come and check us out.
Absolutely,
You know, if we can get you here, I think we can start the beginnings of a relationship. And so, you know, what we do is we say to people, come during the basketball tournament this year, 28th, 29th, 30th November, we will have the Belfast International Homecoming, and that gives people a chance to come into Belfast and see for themselves. So that's the completion of the circle. But I would like to think that we have been giving back to America as well. When both universities are going out to New York to Belfast this week, Queens and UU, and their alumni and the University of South have made big contributions to America. So it has to be a two-way street, and I think that's what works best.
Absolutely. Good for New York, good for New Belfast. The conference is next Thursday and Friday. You can get information, friends, and there are, it's almost, let's say, a sellout, but there are some opportunities left. Why don't you log on to aisling-events.com, aisling-events.com. That's the website which will give you the information on the New York New Belfast Conference. Again, June 7th and 8th. I think if you look through that, you'll get an idea, and participation is very important, and it has a great mix, as you say. It's not one where you're expected just to bring your checkbook. It's a great conference, and good luck to you. We look forward to seeing you on Thursday and Friday. My guest, Andy Martin O'Muilor, who is the founder of the New York New Belfast Conference. Martin, look forward to seeing you.
Well, Adrian, thanks to you and Anya for continuing to be so generous in your allocation of time to Belfast. And I think the message, and you understand this message to all our great supporters and friends in Irish America, is that we face many challenges, as does America, but we're determined with your help that we'll overcome whatever challenges are in the future and continue this onward journey of Belfast and your great company. So thank you very much for having me on the program.
Very welcome indeed. And friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network USA. Our guest there, Martin O'Muilor. And again, it's the New York New Belfast Conference, the 9th annual, taking place at the American Irish Historic Society and indeed at Pier A at Sud Street Seaport, highlighting the bridges of progress and prosperity being built between the citizens of these great cities of New York and Belfast, looking optimistically at the future, celebrating our shared past, our heritage, and again, it's Aisling, aisling-events. And you are listening to Irish Radio Network USA. This is the Flannelly Show, coming to you live from New York City.